Welcome back. It's season two of HugeCast. Like many of you, we're having to do things a little differently here at HugeCast HQ, which means we're recording our guests remotely instead of in our own studio, so you might notice a sound difference. But what hasn't changed is that we have some of the best guests to sit down and have a chat with us. Hold on to your hat, and welcome to HugeCast Season 2.
What's the name of this podcast?
HugeCast.
How am I supposed to pronounce that?
OIGcast.
A huge cast.
Huge cast.
You're listening to
HugeCast.
Hey everybody, it's JoJo, and today we're talking bees. That's right, bees. With Brent Heffley, is that correct?
That's right.
Woo-woo! Of, wait for it, Plan Bees. The best name of any bee company ever. And it's a rescue organization for bees, which makes it even funnier and, again, best name of a bee company ever. Thanks for doing this with me today, Brent. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, I'm super excited to do this. I love to talk about bees and you know, part of the mission of Plan Bees is just to spread information, good information, and help everyone be aware of what's going on out there in the world.
Yeah, that would be great. Like I said, I sent you my email and or Instagram message or whatever, however I reached out to you or stalked you, depending on how you look at it. And I am Team Bees. I'm a big fan of the bees. I try to set some stuff out in my garden every year for bees, plant bee, you know, plants and things like that. But let's just start and talk about just start talking about bees. I know that we had some. Was it Corvallis where they did like the spray and they killed all the bees?
Oh, there was a bumblebee incident there. Somewhere Corvallis or maybe a little farther north. It might have been up by where the Outlet Mall and the Tulip Festival is.
Woodinville.
Woodinville. Have been up there, but you know, so the world of bees is vast. You know, there are a lot of bee species. And you know, honestly, until I really started getting into this via honeybees a decade ago, I had no idea what the scope of the bee world really was. And I don't know or think or expect that most people do. You see honeybees, you know, honeybees, bumblebees, they're super cool. And then, you know, if you know anything about a sweat bee or a mason bee after that, it's, you know, you're up in the 98th percentile, right?
There's something called a sweat bee.
There's a whole obviously whole category not that. Bees, right?
Now, is a sweat bee a native Willamette Valley bee? Because I was reading that there's a ton of Willamette Valley bees on your website, by the way.
Yeah, there are great. You know, there are a lot of Willamette Valley bees, or a lot of bees, you know, within North America. I believe there's somewhere around, no one knows exactly, but somewhere around 2,500 different species of bees
in the Willamette Valley?
Well, no, and that's in the U.S. In the Willamette Valley right now, well, in Oregon, the estimates in Oregon are somewhere between 500 and 650 species of bees.
Wow.
And I first stumbled onto this, it was probably, I want to say 7 or 8 years ago when one of my kids was doing their science fair project for elementary school. And we, you know, we'd been into doing photography outside and I was getting more and more into bees and said, let's do a little thing on, why don't you do one on the native bees of Olive Street? Cause we live on Olive Street, you know, and the project took off and we started taking pictures, which are really hard to do because the native bees and the small bees are super fast. And partway through, I'm like, well, we've got some great pictures, but I have no idea what these are. And it's hard to just Google a picture. Now you can do it more with the Google AI on your phone, right? You can capture a photo and do a search based on that, which is crazy cool. But at the time, that really wasn't an option. So I called Oregon State and I talked to somebody in the entomology department there. And I said, hey, I'm just looking for a list of the native bees in the Willamette Valley or in Lane County or whatever. And they just flat out said, we don't have one. Like, we don't know.
What?
Yeah, that's what I said. Which, you know, they probably had, you know, between within their department there, some reasonable grasp on what those bees were, but there wasn't anything assembled. And, you know, in the last couple of years, they've done this tremendous work as part of the Oregon Bee Project, which is based out of OSU. And they're literally working with citizen scientists across the state to identify and count native bees. So we can actually start to get a baseline of how many we have, what their populations are, how healthy and robust those populations are, and how they're distributed around the state, which is fantastic work. But it was shocking to me at the time that that just didn't exist.
Yeah, I'm surprised totally, because, you know, they've been talking about how endangered bees are for 10 years.
Right.
And, you know, the danger of the honeybee, and we're losing all the bees, and, you know, like what happens to the ecosystem and how screwed we are if the bees go bye-bye, you know? And so,
And that's a really great point. And that's something we should kind of dissect a little bit, because, you know, we kind of dove off into the native bee area, which is great. It's something that I love. But if we step back for a minute and just look at the world of bees, you know, we've got all these different species of bees, and you can kind of divide them up into a few categories. So we have what we call social bees, and then we have, for lack of a better word, singular bees or solo bees.
So, extroverts and introverts?
Yeah, kind of like that.
Well, I'm an introvert bee, just in case you wanted to know.
Right. So the social bees are what we think of as honeybees, right? They're bees that live in a colony with in a group, and they interact with one another, and they have some structured society. You know, with honeybees, you have a queen, you have the female workers, and you have the male drones. So those are social bees, and honeybees are in the genus Apis. So it's Apis mellifera for honeybees. And there are, I think there's around 20 different species in Apis. So there's Apis serrana, the Asian honeybee. There's a number of different ones, Apis africana, the Africanized bees that you've heard about. So there's a lot of different species there. And those are all social bees. Bumblebees are a social bee. They also live in nests that's started by a queen. And they have female workers and males that they produce out of that nest. But, you know, those between the bumblebees and the honeybees, the Apis, there's probably about, I'm going to just take a stab and say 70 to 80 species worldwide. Out of those 2,000 to 3,000, maybe more, in the bee world. So the vast majority of bees out there are singular bees, solo indigenous native bees that have an annual life cycle. So they're often small, they're often hidden. You don't really see them unless you really go looking for them, but they're super important in terms of the ecosystem, which, you know, gets us into the, you know, what are the problems with some of the bees out there, right? Like we've heard all kinds of stuff over the last decade, you know, colony collapse disorder, the bees are all dying, you know, alarm, what's that mean? So
yeah, exactly.
Yeah, and it can be very concerning. And I think there, you know, there's cause to be concerned. But I think we have to temper that and go, okay, what's really going on? Because there are a couple of different things happening in that world, and it's easy to conflate them. So honeybees have been a managed species, you know, depending on how you want to count managed, for somewhere between 500 and 4,000 years.
Right.
Ever since people discovered, oh, this honey thing tastes really good, and I'd love to have some more of it, right?
Right.
You know, we've sought out nests. We've, you know, transported logs that held nests back to closer to where we lived. We devised different ways to get bees to live in structures we've made. You know, all the way up through the middle of the 1800s, when the standard square Langstroth hive that you see out in fields or in somebody's backyard came into being as a way to really manage bees and harvest honey in a way that didn't disrupt them quite as much as some of the previous methods.
Right, to ripping apart their hive.
Right. So you're just more orderly dismantling it than ripping it apart and, you know, giving them back some of the stuff they need. But, you know, honeybees, a lot, and a lot of people don't realize this, are not native to North America. They didn't exist in North America until we brought them over from Europe in the 1700s, I believe.
Oh, well, I did not know that.
Yeah. So they're native, you know, the species is native through Asia, Central Asia, you know, up through the, what would it be, the east coast of Russia. There are a lot of different Asian species of honeybees that have slightly different, I don't want to say life cycles, but different practices. Some of them are more migratory, and they produce honeycomb and brood and honey, and then they move on to another spot. So they move around, partly because the environment there is so constant and so nice. They don't really overwinter like bees that live in a colder climate. So honeybees, we've been managing them, and we manage them for different purposes. So we manage them for honey, obviously. We manage them for pollination. So you've heard of the almond pollination, perhaps. You know, there's blueberries that get pollinated, a lot of different crops that rely on that type of pollination. There's a whole industry built around where literally millions of hives of bees will be carried in to California for the almond pollination each year. I think it's something like 95% of the commercial hives are within, you know, 100 square miles or you know, some really small amount of space for about 6 weeks in February and March.
That must be very loud with the sound of bees.
Yeah, you can imagine. So it's kind of crazy. So when we talk about honeybees being in trouble and stuff, it's not that they're in trouble as in they're endangered, as they're going to go extinct, because they're severely managed. You know, we raise them, we control a huge amount of their population. So when a lot of them die off, we just raise more of them. What it does is it makes them more expensive. And anyone who's been into beekeeping or looked at it in the last few years have noticed, wow, it actually costs quite a bit to get bees now. You know, I think when I started, you could get a package of bees that was raised by, you know, someplace for around $80. And now it's, you know, somewhere between $150 and $170 for those same amount of bees. So, you know, they're having problems. They've got issues with diseases and with parasites. You know, the mite that causes a lot of problems with them now actually came from the Asian honeybee, Apis cerana. They've had a mutual relationship where they coexist with each other for quite a while. But that mite somewhere along the line, probably when there were bigger and bigger Apis mellifera farms in Asia, made the jump and said, hey, these bees look pretty tasty too. Let me go see how I can do in those hives. And it made a species jump. And now it's, you know, one of the biggest issues that honeybees have around the world. So that's what's affecting honeybees, along with, you know, the diseases those mites bring with them that infect the colonies. And that costs commercial beekeepers quite a bit. In costing them quite a bit, it means the people they pollinate for have to pay more for those hives. So it raises the price of almonds, it raises the price of blueberries. It, you know, it creates kind of a cascade of price increases, basically. So when you talk about, you know, the honeybee problems, and there are a lot of people researching this, and we definitely want to try to solve it, you know, for our own, basically to help save our own monoculture practices, is really what it boils down to. You know, honeybees are going to be around most likely. They're going to adapt to these diseases and mites, but it's probably going to take them somewhere on the order of tens of thousands of years to do that. It's a natural process.
Sure.
So it's not like, you know, 20 years from now, they're going to be like, okay, it's all good, we've adjusted, right? It takes lots and lots of generations. So what we're trying to do right now, you know, in the bee scientific community, is find a way to bridge that gap with something that can deter those mites or make them less deadly to the bee colonies, so that, you know, beekeepers commercially aren't having these 40 or 50% losses every year of their colonies.
Are the mites jumping from the honeybees to the solitary bees? Are they impacting those populations as well?
That's a really good question. Not really. And that mostly has to do with the life cycle. There's a very big life cycle difference between those two bees. So when you go to the native bees, their life cycle, well, let's do this. So a honeybee's life cycle is it's the chicken and the egg. So a hive of bees sits there, and this will branch off into a few other topics.
Do I have to take notes? Is there a quiz?
It's a never-ending web. It's kind of fractal. So we can go down any number of 100 different pathways here.
Okay, I've been warned. Yeah.
You've been warned. And no, there won't be a quiz at the end.
Thank God.
So, you have a honeybee hive, and you've got a queen in there. You've got workers. And, during the winter, they kind of go into this, they don't truly hibernate. They just kind of conserve energy. They ball up into a small, group and stay warm and eat their honey supplies to make it through the winter. When spring starts to come out, like we have off and on today every half hour, it starts to warm up. They start to get the signals through nature like, hey, spring's coming. So the queen starts to lay eggs. The workers start to go out and they're collecting pollen right now, primarily because there's not really too much of a nectar flow yet. We're beginning to see a little bit with some of the plums that are out there, maybe some of the willows or whatever. There's probably a few little nectar flows going on. So they're starting to bring that back into the hive. And the ultimate goal of every hive is to become strong enough and healthy enough that they can split and they can swarm. They can send out a half of the bees with the old queen to go and start a new colony, while the workers that stay behind are in the process of raising new queens that will then be the one that takes the place in the colony that they're in. So that's kind of their ultimate goal. So through the course of the year, in the spring, we see swarms from healthy hives. Summer, they're collecting more nectar from all the blackberry blooms and everything through the early summer. And then about in the Willamette Valley anyway, around July 4th, early July, that those nectar flows really slow down. So that source of food starts to disappear. And the bees, believe it or not, go kind of into winter mode then. The queen stops laying quite as much. They're still collecting pollen, but they're kind of battening down the hatches. They're dehydrating the nectar into honey. They're putting wax over the top of it so it stays good. And they're starting to move more into a fall and then into winter mode. And then they slow down through the winter, and in spring they start all over again. But they're doing that continually, so that colony keeps existing unless they get a disease or something that destroys them. So that's the brief on the honeybee life cycle. With native bees, they don't overwinter. Even bumblebees, as a social group of bumblebees, they don't overwinter. What they do is they have an annual life cycle where in late summer, the colony that exists starts to raise new queens. Well, let me back up, because there are actually a couple different pathways to this. So let's move to bumblebees. Bumblebees in the late summer raise new queens. Those queens mate, and then they do go into a type of hibernation over the winter, come out in the spring, and you'll see them now, the really big ones that sound like B-52 bombers going by your head.
Right. I just always looked at those and went like, what are you eating? Mm-hmm. Good Lord.
Yeah, exactly. So they're flying around now, and because they come out of hibernation, and it's just her. All right, here we go. And she goes and finds a place to make a nest. They like pre-built semi-move-in ready places. They like old mouse holes. They like abandoned bird nests, bird boxes, things like that. Something that's protected, that's waterproof, but has some duff and fluff in it that they can start to work with.
Are they're ground dwellers, or are they up high usually?
Great question. Both. So sometimes it's species dependent, where some species are only ground dwellers, others are only tree nesters. And some crossover. Some are more opportunistic and will do either.
I've never seen a bumblebee nest. Never.
Yeah, it's hard, because usually it's a quarter, a hole the size of a quarter or a half dollar, or it's a bird nest, and they make it inside, because the biggest one I've ever relocated was about the size of a dinner plate. They're not huge, because it's only going to exist for 8 months. That's it. You know, it's kind of that whole cycle of life, and they do it very regularly on that year. So she comes out, she finds that mouse hole, she finds that bird house, she finds that nice little cozy spot inside of a half of a pumpkin shell in a compost pile. It's, you know, it's something like that. And then she'll start going out collecting nectar, collecting pollen, and building out her nest. And when she's got it built out enough, she starts laying eggs. And within about, you know, I don't know the full timing, but I would say from the time she comes out of hibernation, it's probably a couple of months, maybe a month and a half at the earliest, where you start to see the first workers emerging. So then the workers come out, and those are the ones you see in the summer, because once she's got enough workers, she more or less stays in that nest and tends to that and lays eggs and makes the, you know, the nest go, and all the workers are going out collecting. So you'll see the smaller versions of her through the summertime. And those are the cute ones you see on all the flowers out and, you know, kind of just cruising around, the ones kids pick up in their hands because they're, you know, they're great. They can sting, but they're not prone to. So those are what you'll see in the summertime. And then late summer will come along. She'll start raising new queens in the nest, and those queens will go mate, and they'll go into hibernation. And, you know, a nest might raise, you know, say they raise 20 queens. You know, some of them won't make it through the winter, depending on how harsh the winter is or the spot they chose to hibernate. Some will get eaten by birds, whatever. So the remaining queens come out in the spring, and they start the cycle again.
Fascinating. I mean, honeybees are kind of like the rock stars of the bee world, right?
We only
hear about the honeybees. Like, I'm familiar with mason bees. My mom has a farm, so I'm again pro bee, but I never heard. I mean, I love bumblebees. I didn't know any of that.
Right.
None of it.
Yeah, I mean, 7 or 8 years ago, I didn't either. You know, it's something that I've just been super fascinated by. And when I started Plan Bees, you know, I started Plan Bees because when I first got into beekeeping and I bought bees, and then I thought, I heard about this thing called swarms when I took the Lane County Beekeepers Association Bee School, which is highly, highly recommended for anyone thinking about beginning to keep bees. Go check them out. They're lcbaor.org, the Lane County Beekeepers Association.
We'll put that in our show notes too.
Yeah, great people, great resources. But you know, I learned about swarms when you learn about beekeeping and the fact that you can collect them. So I thought that was super cool. And when I went to do a search for swarms or bee swarms or bee swarms Eugene, you know, the first page of things that came up in my Google results were exterminators.
No.
Right.
No.
So that's the exact reaction I had. And I thought, wow, this is crazy. So I need to do something about this. So I started Plan Bees, and that's how I learned about how to make a website, how to do, you know, search engine optimization and all this stuff. It led me down another rabbit hole, but that's not, we're not going to talk about that today. But in any case, I'm happy now to say now that if you search that, you know, my little community service comes up there with, you know, generally above the exterminators. And there's been enough education out in the world that most exterminators won't touch bees. They will refer somebody calling them to the Lane County Beekeepers Association, to me, to Oregon State, to someplace.
That's great.
That can better deal with it. So there's been a huge shift in awareness since I've begun doing this, which is, it's fantastic when I show up and somebody really knows, you know, oh, this is important. You know, we don't want to call it an exterminator. We want these bees to a safe place. And it's really, really amazing, that shift.
Yeah, they're just trying to live their bee life in their swarm. And so, I mean, like you just said, it's part of their life cycle. And we're the one that are getting in the way. So I'm really glad to hear that people aren't just like, gas the little bastards, you know.
Right. And, you know, that's the worst calls I get are from people who are, they're renting and they're calling because they're saying, you know, my landlord wants to spray these. I'm trying to find a way to save them, you know, and I'm like, I'll be there in 20 minutes, you know, I take off and get them. And, you know, and kind of an interesting thing about this is, you know, you think one of the natural questions is, well, if they're swarming and this is what they want to do, why do you need to collect them, right? Why do you need to rescue a swarm? They know what they're doing, which is mostly true. However, what happens in an urban environment, you know, like Eugene Springfield, is if you have a swarm that comes out of somebody's hive or even from a tree hive, you know, because there are a number of trees in the area here that have nice cavities and they're honeybees in there. When they swarm, the likelihood of them finding another natural cavity is pretty slim. The likelihood of them finding the eave of somebody's house, a hole in the wall of a building or a chimney is quite high. And once they get in there and they start making their nest, it's a mess to take them out. It's time consuming and it's really hard on them. You know, so the more swarms that we can, you know, we being, you know, any beekeeper within the Eugene area can capture during swarm season, put them in a hive. Not only are they in a safer place where they're not likely to be hurt or sprayed or something at a later point, they can also be managed for disease, you know, so you can do things to help mitigate the mite problem, to help increase their immune systems, to help keep them in a good environment where they're not going to contract these diseases that they have problems with.
Yeah, I mean, it is definitely a community service, but it's also just the right thing to do because, you know,
You know, if you're out in the middle of the forest and there was a swarm, it's like, great, they're probably going to find a really cool tree and they're going to be good to go. They still may have some of the disease problems, but they're not going to get into a situation, you know, where somebody's going to have to have them removed from a chimney or someplace else.
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah. Again, Team B. And again, going back to the thing that I said at the very beginning is like, we're still responsible for them. You know, it's the important thing to do. Since we're again encroaching on so much other environmental stuff, it's the least we can do to just. Right. I mean, and especially if there's somebody that's willing to go and grab the swarm, then you know.
Yeah, and most beekeepers that are on the swarm, you know, there's a swarm list, so it's on that Lane County Beekeepers Association website, and there's actually a swarm list, and they have it for all of Lane County, so. You know, whether you're in Yoncalla or if you're on Yahats or, I mean, actually, I'm not even sure if that's still Lane County. But anyway, if you're on the coast.
No, that's Lincoln County.
so if you're in Blue River or whatever, there are people in all those areas that are happy to collect swarms because they get to bring it back to their bee yard and add another colony in and they can take care of it and do great things. So. It's definitely something to call about. And I often, you know, I get, just because of the website, I get a lot of calls each year and, you know, I'll end up referring those out to other people in those areas. All, you know, cause I know a number of people or have worked with them over time and, you know, I don't need all those colonies. I end up with way more calls than I can handle every year. But one of the things I've decided to do this year, and it was one of those things that just kind of hit me is, you know, I never like selling bee swarms and there's nothing really wrong with it, but just personally, I don't like commodifying bees that way. Yeah. The last few years I've had people reach out and go, hey, I'd love to get a swarm. I'll pay you for it, whatever. And, you know, I was kind of like, oh, you know, I'll just bring them over or whatever. But, friends of mine say, you know, it's your time and you should charge for it. But what I decided I'm going to do this year and probably ongoing is, I'm actually going to do a sliding scale donation for those bees. And then that money is going to go towards some of our local charities that help homeless kids that are living on the street. So I haven't finalized it, but I'm going to call it something like Homeless Bees Helping People. Kind of closing the circuit, which I mean, it's kind of a win-win-win. I get to go out and play with bees. Somebody gets a new bee swarm in their hive and we get to help our own community, which I think is, a great solution for just everybody involved.
Absolutely. And keep me posted when you get that information and we'll update all of this stuff. We'll do a little shout out for you when you get that done.
Yeah. Because, cool.
That's amazing. That's amazing. That's the perfect thing to do. It doesn't monetize. I mean, it monetizes the swarms, but it doesn't, you know,
It's not just a capitalistic transaction. It's a community. Right. It just expands kind of the community service that Planes is. So I'm really excited about that, and it'll keep me motivated after I've already collected 25 swarms during the year. I'm like, another Thursday afternoon, and I've got 5 swarm calls, and I'm not sure if I have the energy for it, you know, which definitely happens, as much as I love it, sometimes. So
the Eugene, I grew up in Portland, and we had OMSI, and one of like the standard bearers for going to visit OMSI for forever when I was growing up was you got to stop by the bees. Because, you know, they had like the big thing and then the little tube that goes outside. And and I think that doesn't the Eugene Science Center, doesn't our like.
Right.
Don't they have like I don't know if they don't.
I don't know. I'm not sure. It's been, you know, my kids are older now. It's been a long time since I've been there. But, you know, that's probably my first introduction to it, too. I grew up in Kansas. And the University of Kansas and their Natural History Museum had that same thing, that observation hive built into the wall of the museum, right off the stairwell. And it was the coolest thing to go and watch those bees.
Yeah, it is the coolest thing. So, I mean, there was a point to what I was saying is that because that is one of the coolest things ever for kids. I don't know any kids that kind of go, unless they're probably allergic to bees, but most kids are fascinated by bees. They like to watch them and look at them and, you know, hopefully not try to pet them. But but, you know, I'm a big fan of the bees, and I like watching them in my yard, and I'm always trying to, you know, like, how can I plant for bees? And I tried to do like a butterfly bee garden, like a bee feeder, a butterfly bee feeder. I was not successful.
Well, you know, let's talk about that, because that's a really interesting thing. And that's one of the things I want to try to address in coming years as another piece of the community service of Plan Bees. And it's, you know, how can any individual in the area help the bees? And, you know, a couple of things to kind of recognize is, you know, honeybees, you know, they're generalists. So that means they will go and forage from a huge number of flowers and pull in pollen and nectar from a lot of different sources. So they're going out in the morning, the early scout bees and the early workers that are out flying and collecting this, and they'll go way up in the air, and they'll start looking for big patches of things, because they want efficiency. They want to be able to come back to the hive and tell another 5,000 bees, here's the place to go. Right. So if you've got 50 zinnias blooming in your backyard, they're probably not going to pick that. You know, they're going to say, hey, there's this acre that's overgrown with blackberries that no one's tended to in years, and it is in full bloom, and we've got to go to it now. Or, you know, the willows on Amazon Creek are all blooming right now, or, you know, whatever it is. And they're looking for big patches of stuff. And that's, you know, that's what they're going to primarily go to. You know, they will come and visit your backyard. They're in our backyard, our neighbor's backyard and around, but what they're really looking for most of the year are those bigger sources.
So I'm only getting the lazy bees. Fly that far, dude. You go ahead and do that. I'm gonna go to JoJo's yard. It's fine.
That's right. You know that other place. That sounds kind of far away. There's some good looking flowers right over here. I'm gonna go over to JoJo's. I'll be back in a bit. Just like the corner bar, right?
That's right.
But what you do get, and what you can get with these with a backyard garden like that, and you can be a huge resource for the native bees, for the smaller, you know, solo lifestyle annual bees that we have 500 or 600 species of here in Oregon. You know, that's a really important thing, because they're much more specific in the plants that they pollinate and that work with their life cycle. Some of them are actually basically joined to, you know, are very closely joined to particular plants where they come out of their egg or their, you know, their protective shell. Because there's different life cycles, some overwinter as adults, some overwinter as eggs, but they'll come out the same time that these plants are blooming. Like mason bees that you mentioned before, you know, are going to come out earlier in the year now. Matter of fact, I had a couple of mine hatch this week, as the early fruit trees are blooming, right? Like the plums are in bloom now. We're going to have, you know, Asian pears blooming. We're going to have apples blooming. So they're going to come out during this period. And by midsummer, you know, they're mostly done. You know, their life cycle outside of being in a little cocoon is probably only 3 months.
Wow.
Yeah. And some native bees are even shorter than that.
So when you say life cycle, does that mean like they have their wild 3 months of this crazy life and then they die? Or do they just go back into hibernation and just go, wow, that was a lot. Now I just need to rest.
Right. I've got a hangover, a nectar hangover. I've got to go hibernate for a few months. No, they actually die. That's their cycle. They, you know, and it's actually, unfortunately, probably a lot more of a work life than a party life, because they start out, and again, depending on their life site, the type of native bee, some of them mate before they go into that. Well, take that back. That's probably partially true. Some of them do mate, the bumblebees more so than the native bees. But you know, the native bees, the small ones, the mason bees, they'll come out, they'll hatch out. They actually overwinter as adults in these little pods that you can buy at, you know, Down to Earth or Backyard Farmer. There's also a guy, Mason Bee Supply here in Eugene, that raises and is a great source for mason bees. But you know, they come out as they hatch as adults, and mate, and then the female basically starts to work putting together more pods for the next generation, where she's gathering some nectar, she's gathering some pollen, she's rolling it into these little bee bread balls, and she's putting it with an egg and sealing it inside this little cocoon that's waterproof, so that that it can hatch, the larvae can grow, develop into an adult bee, and then hibernate over the winter and start again. Super interesting.
Yeah. I'm speaking just for myself, is that I certainly don't know hardly anything about our solitary native bee population, because it's all, like I said, honeybees are the rock stars, but it sounds like this, all the solitary bees that have this shorter life cycle, that there's so many of them. And every once in a while I have on the back of the hill behind my house is, you know, we kick up something in the ground. Uh-huh. And, you know, sometimes it's a bee, but sometimes it's a hornet, you know.
Right, right.
But so I think we didn't quite get there, is how can I plant to support the native single bees?
So don't feel bad that you don't know much, because literally as a society, as a culture, we didn't really know much except for, you know, a few small groups of entomologists scattered across the nation, you know, about our native bee populations, as it were. Like, you know, OSU is doing a great job with the Oregon Bee Project and the Oregon Bee Atlas to establish this. But we're, you know, I don't know exactly how many states are doing this, but it's not the majority. You know, there are a number of states that don't even have this type of project going on yet.
Wow.
So there's it's a huge new area. And basically what those native bees need is not much different than any other, you know, animal or insect. They need a food source and they need shelter, right? They need, you know, they need those things. And we talk a lot about planting for bees and what flowers that'll attract bees and butterflies and hummingbirds. One of the things that we don't talk about is where do they live and what do they need to live? And that's probably the most important aspect. And it's why native bees are really having a lot of the problems they are. They're not in general having issues with disease yet. They are having issues with pesticides, and they are having issues with lack of habitat, lack of places to call home, because they are either ground nesters or they're stem nesters generally. You know, and with thousands out there are other types, but let's just focus on those, because that's the ones we can help the most. So the ground nesters need undisturbed soil, and that includes basically mowing. So if you think about all the surface of, you know, the Eugene Springfield area, that's either paved, that's compacted or is mowed, those are all off the table for our native
bees.
Yeah.
Really? Okay. Yeah. Well, because
and land that's tilled, including your garden, if you dig it up and turn it over. So,
right.
So it needs to, there needs to be a spot that is just there that nobody, you can probably walk on it some, but you don't dig it up. You know, you don't mow it. You just leave it there. And that gives the ground nesters a place to be. Now, you can also plant that with flowers and plants that they're going to go to. And Oregon State has a great list of plants that that you can put in that help native bees and help pollinators. So I can get you the link for that to put in the show notes as well.
That would be great. Yeah.
But there are definitely resources out there for what to plant, but you really need a space. And it doesn't have to be giant. I like to think of those spaces as like maybe a 10 by 10 area. And, you know, maybe that's the strip between your sidewalk and the road, you know, that's 3 feet wide and 30 feet long, you know, something like that are ideal places that can be habitat for all of these species of native bees.
Okay. You know, because one of the things that we've run up against, I'm just thinking again, I have this hillside that it's perfect for that, because it's not like I go up there and till the really crappy ground, but I do have to mow it, because if I don't, then I get the nasty gram from the city that says, now you have fire danger.
Right.
So, but I can make a 10 by 10 patch that's like, don't mow, we're not going to mow this section, we're going to leave this section alone.
Right.
And I now that you say that, but it has to be fairly big. Is that right? Or can it be like a smaller patch in your garden?
You know, that's a really good question. And that's actually the something that I want to talk to the people at Oregon State about more, because I don't know what the bigger, the better, obviously. Right. Because it gives them opportunities. I don't know what the minimum size truly would be for that. I'm guessing that it's probably somewhere in that neighborhood, but you know, I've got a stretch in our backyard that's kind of an easement between our house and our neighbors. And it's probably about 3 feet wide, and it's, you know, about in total about 50 feet long. But there's about a 20 foot long section of it that, you know, I've planted I put a nine bark out there. It's got parsley that's just reseeding itself. It's got probably some calendula, just, you know, miscellaneous stuff that's spread out there from our yard stuff. And I just leave it. And, you know, every once in a while, if it gets too much, I might take those big, like, clippers that you hold with both hands, the long scissor looking things, and just chop off the tops, let it fall.
Okay.
But, and this is another important part, because that's where you make the homes for the stem nesters, which are the other big part of the native bee world. So one of the things that I think a lot of people, that's never told to a lot of people who make bee gardens that plant flowers and stuff, is, you know, they plant the flowers, bees come, great. End of the year, they either cut it down to the ground, or in the next spring, they cut it out and start by planting more. Well, that just took away the home opportunities for all the stem nesting bees, because what the stem nesting bees need are those dead stems, the raspberry canes at the end of the year that you chop off, that have that little pithy hole in the very center. So there's that little hole. They need those. That's where they nest.
Oh.
And if you think about the cycle of the bees and the plants, so you have let's take a raspberry, because that's a great example, right? Raspberries grow, you eat the raspberries, fall comes, they kind of die back. And at some point you go out and you're like, oh, I need to cut these down. Well, if you cut them halfway, you just made a great native bee home. If you cut it all the way, you've taken that bee home away. But
I've murdered bees.
Right.
I've murdered bees.
You just took down their apartment complex.
Oh, crap.
Well, you haven't killed them yet, because they haven't actually nested there, because that once you cut it, that makes the home. But it's not until the next spring or early summer, when they've come out and started developing their lifestyle, that they actually even use it. So it has to sit there through that next spring, summer.
Okay.
They have their eggs and pods in there, so it has to go all the way through the next fall to the next spring. So it has to be in place at least 18 months.
Okay.
For that full
life
cycle.
Next year I will do better. Okay,
right?
I'll do better. Yeah.
So if you cut that off, think about that. So if you chop it in the fall, it's sitting there waiting. You get it gets inhabited in the spring. It gets hibernated in through that whole, you know, the eggs go through the life cycle there, that whole next fall and winter. And it's not until the following spring, 18 months later, when they start to emerge. So it really needs to be that, it needs to be that half kept, you know, plot of ground for a couple of years before you really start building that bee population.
This is excellent because you just gave me a reason to be a half-ass gardener.
Exactly. Bees love that. Nature loves messy, you know?
Good. Okay.
Nature loves messy.
Yeah. So for things like, I mean, all of this information is brand spanking new to me.
It's a lot, right?
it is a lot. And yeah. I have to believe somewhere in the cockles of everybody's heart, we do care about bees. We especially care about our native bees because, you know, there are native bees. Is the Oregon Bee Project the best place to go if somebody like me is like, oh no, I'm a bee myrtleizer? is the Oregon Bee Project the best place to go to get further actions? So like, do this, don't do this kind of stuff.
Yeah. They've got a good resource. And it's, you know, honestly, you know, this is all stuff that's really being developed. So Oregon Bee Project is definitely one of the leaders in the country, I believe. In furthering this research. There's some great stuff going on the East Coast too, and in Canada, but you know, they do a fantastic job. So Oregon Bee Project is one. The Oregon State Extension Service is fantastic, with a lot of different stuff. Unfortunately, like, you know, sometimes I go through and I wish there's a little bit more organization, but I know they're going to get there. It's, you know, it's been a year of COVID, right? A lot of people are working from home on this stuff, and it's, you know, they've kind of lost a year, I think, in some of the organization. But so the Oregon State Extension Service is great. The Lynn Benton Master Gardeners, fantastic. They just hosted the big pollinator event online a few weeks ago, and there were some great talks about pollination, native pollinators, all things to do with that sector of our ecosystem. So we actually live in a really great place for this. So even if you don't know a lot about it, there are resources, there's people that are willing to teach you. I want to evolve some of Plan B's, my website, into having some of that, or at least a list of the great resources. I don't need to, you know, duplicate, or nor could I, what the Oregon Bee Project's doing and the Oregon Bee Atlas, where they're trying to map out all the species. But that's great. There's also a site called Bumblebee Watch, which is more of a national site, but they have a lot of great information specifically on bumblebees. So I'll get you links for this stuff so we can put it in the notes for anyone who wants to go visit those. But you can also pretty easily just do an online search for Oregon native bees, and this stuff will come up. It's good that way.
I saw that there was a guy, is it Bruce Johnson, who's written a couple books about bees, native bees, and he's out of OSU. Is he one of the dudes?
And honestly, I don't know all the, you know, because there's people who are like writing stuff about this that are kind of behind the scenes in some of this, the Bee Project, versus the people who are out doing, you know, there's Dr. Adoni Melithopoulos, who does the pollination podcast up there. And I love listening to that podcast. It's probably one of my favorite things. Of course, it's very geeky, right? It's
shocking. It's
great. But, you know, it's also fun at the same time. And you know, mostly accessible. It does dive pretty deep into some topics. But, you know, there are really a lot of great people working on that. So we've got things happening. There's a lot of good stuff that'll be coming out, and I'm just hoping to help relay that and educate people. And, you know, in this way, one-on-one, when I go and collect bee swarms or take calls about bumblebees, things like that, because it's, you know, just my little part of trying to help.
Yeah. Well, as with a lot of things, it's like we talk about honeybees and we kind of go, well, we're done, thanks so much, and then you know, like, we've barely scratched the surface of things that are bees. But I want to just kind of reiterate here for my own benefit, and I don't know if anybody listens to these things, but so get a nice swath of land and don't disturb it and leave it alone. That's number one.
Yeah. Plant some of the plants that Oregon State has on their list. You know, there's native plants that some of those native bees are really tied to. But I also personally kind of like to do a combination of stuff like that, but also some hardier, you know, maybe I don't want to say not natives, but stuff that's not invasive, but something that is going to come up like a, you know, a calendula or a marigold, something that as our climate shifts and as we have years that are that fall outside of the norm, where we've got a really late spring or a super early spring or whatever. And, you know, yeah, that's the danger to a lot of the native species, is that if the timing of their hatch and the flowering of the plant that they're associated with get disrupted, then they don't have any food. Like they're not going to survive very long at all. And as annual life cycle, you know, insects, those populations will decrease quickly. And in some parts of the country with some species, we've already seen 70 to 90% declines in their populations. I mean, it's serious. The stuff that came out of Germany last year on the insect studies, where they've seen a general decline in close to 80 at, to the level of close to 80% in insect populations there. That's really the existential threat we face. It's not the honeybees. The honeybees we already talked about what that means is managed bees, but the native insects, the native pollinators, and the declines they have there. Oh, 2 million blossoms is another great resource of general pollination and pollinator things that's out there on the web. But that's really the big threat, because if those decline, then we've got a lot of problems. The stuff that honeybees don't pollinate, the food for birds, right? You start to see the cascade into, oh, what are those birds going to eat? Oh, they're going to eat seeds and berries. Well, what if those little native bees didn't pollinate those plants, right? Then there's no seeds and berries on those plants for those birds to eat. You know, you really can just follow that all the way through. Shane, right?
Yeah, it's like, you know, it's a big damn deal. It's a big damn deal. And so
it is. If you have. And it's something we can do something about pretty easily and pretty quickly, you know, and the more people become aware of this, it's not hard to say, oh, I'm going to take that 10 by 10 piece of my yard and just do nothing with it except put these five native plants there, and I'm going to ignore it. Right. Like that's the work you need to do.
I'm going to have to go to the store and buy a whole seed packet of bachelor buttons.
There you go.
Because I love those. And I have a deer issue here, but I can just take that 10 by 10 though, and just, you know, throw some of that stuff on there and see if we can't get, I mean, I even like know which patch of the land I'm going to use, but I think that people do better when they know better that we, you know, so we can't do better until we know what we need to do. And I heard this forever ago, and you have kids, and I'm sure that you know this, but you can't be curious about stuff you don't know anything about.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I think that if we can all do our part, whether it's a 10 by 10 patch, if you have that, or why not a 3x3 patch? Like at least give it a go.
Absolutely. Something's better. Go out and get some echinacea, some yarrow, you know, currant, you know, some sage that flowers, stuff like that. Cause if you put perennials in there, then you literally can just like let it go.
Yeah.
You know, you don't have to go and seed it or dig in it. You can get a few things like that help them. And then it creates the little holes around the, you know, the root structure for the ground nesting bees. You know, you chop off the tops, or, you know, in some cases let them die naturally, and they form the little pithy stems that the stem dwellers can nest in. And, you know, it's, you set it up and forget it.
The raspberry thing I can totally do. And I will start being more mindful about, you know, leaving some stems behind.
Yeah.
Because I have other plants that you're just like, well, damn it, I just ruined another condo.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it's tricky because it's really, you know, it's not our garden norm. You know, you drive around town, and you see yards that are really like nicely kept, and they've got barkle mulch, and they've got, you know, these, the ornamental plants and stuff. And it's, you know, I look at that and I go, you know, wasteland for native bees, you know?
Right. Way to kill our friends, man. Yes, so, these are not helpful to us. Yeah.
Right.
Well, if people want to, if they want to, well, A, if they want to call you because they have a swarm or see a swarm, how do they get a hold of you?
Yep. So, you know, you can go to, you can really, you can Google, you know, bee swarms in Eugene and I'll probably come up, but planbees.com is the email or the website, plan-bees.com.
Okay.
You know, you can call me at 541-854-0358, which is also on the website. I'm on Instagram. I'm on Twitter. I'm on Facebook, although I'm not sure how long that's going to last. But but you can also go to, you know, for swarms, you can also go to the Lane County Beekeepers Association. They've got a great swarm list, lots of great people on there. You know, there are a lot of resources for that. But the thing to do is, if you see them, don't panic. You know, it really is a bee swarm is a force of nature, and it's amazing. You know, it's frightening at first because you've got somewhere in the order of 10 or 15,000 bees that are this huge cloud that just flew through your yard and start collecting around a bush or a tree, and they're flying everywhere because they're traveling by smell, basically. And,
wow.
You know, it can be really intimidating and really frightening, but they're not prone to sting. It doesn't mean they won't, but generally they're a group of homeless bees, and all those workers are just trying to follow the lead and the queen. And they go out and they stage themselves around her and protect her in this ball of bees, which is that's the picture you always see of a bee swarm, right? That little pine cone shaped, well, it's a big pine cone shape. They're usually, you know, a foot to a foot and a half tall and maybe 10 inches to 12 inches around at the top, cone that forms on a tree branch or a fence or, you know, an archway in your garden or something like that. And, you know, once they're in place, they're pretty much just hanging out because they send out these scouts to look for new homes. And while they're doing that, they're just there to protect the queen and kind of stay out of the way of birds or any other predators that might, you know, want to eat them.
Wow. Okay. That's kind of cool. And
yeah.
Is it wrong that I kind of hope there's a swarm in my backyard?
That'd
be really cool.
It's super cool. I actually had the chance last year. I went to collect a swarm and it was in a tree branch over somebody's roof. And I was up on the roof and I, you know, it took me a while to get the ladders, get everything up there. And I was up there and I was just about to put the swarm bucket that I use underneath them and shake them into it when they decided to take off. And
oh, crap.
It was just like I was standing there in the middle of a river of bees as they just like flew right around me. It was epic. It was one of the most amazing experiences just to be enveloped by them as they flew more or less through me, around me, up there on that rooftop. It was really cool.
Did you have to chase them across town? Wait for me.
No, it's one of those things. I watched where they went. They took off. I kind of drove over to see if I could find them. I couldn't see them. And, you know, at that point, it is a wild goose chase. So I just let them go do whatever they were going to do.
Oh, I hope they have a long, happy bee life.
I hope so, too. Yeah. I hope so, too. Well,
the last thing I want to ask you, because I warned you about this already.
You did.
Before we go. Because 2020 sucked hard, and we had murder hornets. Did we ever get any murder hornets in Oregon, and specifically down here in Eugene? Because, oh my God, those things scared the crap out of me, because I saw a picture of one.
Yeah. So, you know, there's a reason the people up in Washington and Canada are working so hard to try to find all those nests, because, you know, if they do get established here, they're going to be here, you know, they're going to move around the country. You know, and they are, you know, I've never seen one in person. I've seen the pictures, I've seen, you know, the stuff, but you know, they are a big hornet. You know,
they
can tear apart a bee colony pretty fast. I really wouldn't want to get stung by one. That's for sure. You know, they, if they do get established in North America, they'll be here. It's probably, you know, it's one of those things where as that type of, as a hornet or yellow jackets, wasp, all of these, that type of species, you know, they follow the path of the bumblebees in terms of life cycle, where they have a annual life cycle where they, there's a colony, they raise queens in the late summer, early fall, those queens go out and hibernate and they start over anew. So basically the way they expand geographically is once those queens come out of hibernation, they fly off to find a good home, you know, and they may be, you know, 50 yards apart, they might be 500 yards apart, they might be a kilometer apart, and then the next year they expand again. So, you know, they are, they do move pretty slowly in terms of geographic area when left to their own natural resources. It's not like one of those queens is taken off, you know, on the Canadian border and going, hey, let's go see what Oregon looks like, right? Like they're, they're not going to make it that far. They will make it that far in produce crates or, you know, when people transport them accidentally. That's the other way they spread. And, you know, I don't know, honestly, enough about their particular habits or how they might get spread that way. But, you know, if they, we're talking their natural spread, we've got a while before they would get to us. But, you know, 20 years from now, it's very possible.
That is the stuff of nightmares.
It is a bit. And, let's, and one other nightmare, that's something that is, I'm glad you brought this up, because I tell everybody I know about this, because one of the things we all rue in Oregon are those beautiful summer afternoons where you're having your picnic outside and all of a sudden the yellow jackets show up.
Yes. Right?
You know, midsummer, they're going crazy and you go out and you buy a trap at the hardware store and you fill it up like daily. Go out this weekend and buy those traps. Because right now is when all the yellow jacket queens are coming out of hibernation, just like the bumblebee queens. And for the next month, those yellow jacket queens are going to be establishing their nests. They're going to be flying around. They're going to be finding food. And if you trap a queen, you eliminate that colony for the entire year.
Okay.
So you eliminate about 15 or 20,000 yellow jackets in July if you trap one of those queens now in March.
Okay, done and done. Yeah, we're talking today on the 20th, which is the equinox. Right. So the first day of spring. So today is the day.
It is the day. Well, so I usually recommend to people you get two of those traps, put one in your front yard, one in your backyard, tell your neighbors, have them tell their neighbors, and you can, you know, you may not catch any, but just remember, like, it only takes one or two. You know, I think the best year I've caught 12 in one trap.
Nice.
Worst year I've caught none, you know, but it's one of those things, it's hit or miss, but it's worth the, you know, $11.95 or whatever those traps are to put them out now. And because you can rebait it, you know, they're reusable, the green or the yellow ones, and they have a pheromone. They don't attract honeybees. They don't attract anything else. It's a very, very yellow jacket specific pheromone that they use in there. If you trap them, that's great. If you get one in a trap and you're like, oh my God, what do I do with it now? Just pull the trap down and stick it in your freezer overnight. In the morning, you can just take that, you can open it up and that yellow jacket will be dead. You can dump it in the compost pile or the trash or whatever you want to do. But put them out now and you hopefully will catch a couple and really eliminate those colonies for the year.
Oh, done. I got to hang up on you now because I have to go get my yellow jacket traps out. I'll see you later. Thanks so much.
I need to go do that too. So we have a little sun shower here.
That's right. Hey, thank you so much. I have enjoyed this so immensely. Fun. I appreciate you taking the time to do this and all the tips and hints and things like that for our friends, the bees, and then also for to myrtleize the yellow jackets. I'm a big fan.
Excellent. Well, Jojo, thanks for having me on. It was really, really a lot of fun.
Absolutely. And we will put all of those links in the show notes should anybody have any questions. Thanks again so much. Enjoy the rest of your weekend and we'll be in touch. You got to let me know about the homeless bees feeding the homeless kids.
Yep, I will. I will. For
That's
sure.
Awesome. Okay. Have a great rest of your weekend.
Yeah, take care.
Okay. Bye.
Bye.
And now for some housekeeping. HugeCast would like to thank its contributors, volunteers, and sponsors. A huge thanks goes out to
Mark Davis at Eugene Tech for providing guidance and enthusiasm, to Trefoya for providing equipment, space, beverages, and the occasional pizza, and to That Supergirl for providing web hosting. Our producer is Kimberly Noel. Music and soundscapes conceived by Mike Jones. Audio editors include Mike Jones and Christopher Mitchell. Audio engineer is Christopher Mitchell. HugeCast hosts are the amazing Adam Wendt and the delightful JoJo Jensen. If you like what you hear, please give us a review. 5 stars would be nice. And who knows, we might even read your comments during the show. So thanks for listening, or sleeping through it. Either way, thanks.